Thanks, Tamara. Evening, everyone. I just find that Good Friday is one of those really profound times. It's already tonight, as we sing together, as we've seen the testimony, as we've reflected together on something that Jesus has done. I've found, even within myself, I've been stirred about God's grace that He's shown to me over many years, but particularly when He brought me to know His Son Jesus 28 years ago. So it's wonderful to be together. In the early 18th century, there was a man by the name of John Newton. He grew up in a home where his mum tried to teach him the Bible, but she died when he was 7. And so with his dad, he went to sea when he was aged 11 and became a sailor, pretty tough, rough sort of life. And he had all sorts of difficult experiences. As an adult, he became the captain of his own ship, a slave trading ship, taking slaves from Africa and selling them. John Newton, by his own account, was a man who was as far from God as you could get. He had no time for God. He was an angry man. He was a foul-mouthed man. He was a slave trader. One night he's at sea on his ship. A violent storm comes up, so violent it crushed a hole in the side of the ship and water was flooding in. He cried out to God, asking God to save him. And God answered the prayer. The waves shifted the ship, the cargo moved in the hold and plugged up the hole, and the boat stopped filling with water and they were able to limp to shore. Now, John Newton was so struck by that answered a prayer, that immediately once he began reading his Bible and other Christian books and seeing if the things that he had been taught as a child could be true and if this Jesus was someone that he would follow. He became a Christian. He recognised that in Jesus there was forgiveness for all sins, and even a wretch like him could come back to God. And so he did. He went on, eventually became a Christian minister, eventually went on and supported William Wilberforce as he worked to abolish the English slave trade, which he did effectively. Now, as a minister, John Newton also wrote a number of Christian songs, but his most famous song is the song Amazing Grace. We got it up there. It's really little, really small, but lots of you are young. Amazing Grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. Now, these are famous words. These are perhaps the most famous Christian song that has ever been written. People who are Christians know it. People who are not Christians know it. And these words are so powerful because they're John Newton's story. See, at heart, he recognised, he felt he was a wretch, far from God, distant from God. But God, in His incredible grace, had reached out to him and drawn him back to God, opened his eyes so he could see, and found him when he was lost. But I reckon that this song is so well known and so regarded and has kept being sung throughout the ages, because it's not just John Newton's song, it's our song. It's a song that every Christian sings, whether they use these words or not. It's our story. It's my story. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saves a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. And it's every Christian story. And it was great to hear it sung for us before, earlier in the service. Now, here's some more famous words. Also written by a man who was far from God, though by a man who thought he was close to God. A man by the name of Saul of Tarsus. He was a Jew, a zealous Jew. He was a Jew around in Jesus' day, and he thought Jesus was a liar, a blasphemer, and had rightly been executed. And he thought Christians were liars too. And so he went around arresting Christians, capturing Christians, putting them in prison, and executing, murdering Christians. This man, though, meets the risen Lord Jesus, actually truly raised from the dead, and Jesus forgives him. And so he too becomes a follower of Jesus, and not just a follower of Jesus, but one of his greatest ambassadors, and his name is changed to Paul the Apostle. Now, these are Paul's words also about the amazing grace shown to him by God. For it is by grace you've been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves. It's the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. See, he too understood God's amazing grace to him. In fact, this is probably where John Newton got the words for his song from, or other passages like it from the Apostle Paul. What we're going to do this evening is look at this sentence from the Bible and remind ourselves of how astounding that God's grace to us is. And we're going to do it by looking at four key words: grace, saved, faith, works. Firstly, grace. Now, what's grace? Well, grace is a beautiful word. a truly beautiful word. We thought it was such a beautiful word that our first daughter, we wanted to give the name Grace, but our last name is Fuller, so she'd be Grace Fuller. We thought, oh, you can't do that. So middle name, we did it for the middle name. And if you called the first one Grace Fuller, well, you'd have to call the second one Beauty Fuller. And then we had a son, and we'd call him Dread Fuller. Now, we didn't go with that. But we did give her the middle name, Grace, because the meaning behind the word grace is just such a beautiful, wonderful thing. Now, it's not a common word that we hear today. Whenever you hear someone hear the word grace, it's usually they're saying, let's say grace, which means let's pray and give thanks before the meal starts. But what does grace actually mean? Well, most simply, the most simple definition that I've found most helpful is this. Grace means generosity. Whenever I see in the Bible, whenever I see in a verse, whenever I see in the song Amazing Grace, the word grace, I substitute in my mind generosity. Amazing generosity. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Or it is by generosity you've been saved. Straight away that makes things heaps more clear to me. That when we're speaking about the grace of God, the amazing grace of God, we're speaking about God's incredible generosity towards us, the incredible gift or gifts that God has given towards us. Amazing grace, amazing generosity, how sweet the sound. Now, we might be able to come up with other words for amazing, because amazing is just trying to capture how astounding, how big, how wonderful, how magnificent, how generous God has been to us. And so we might come up with words like incredible, incredible grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Now, that doesn't really roll off the tongue, does it? Or astounding grace, or overwhelming grace. But none of these really roll off the tongue. I'll tell you the one I like that I think rolls off the tongue is crazy grace. Crazy grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. Because if you understand God's grace, what you understand is it's crazy. It's absurd. That the God of the universe could be so generous and kind to me. But you probably can't call it crazy grace because that sounds like it could be a person. So we won't do that. God's grace to us, his generosity, is so crazily incredible, it's mind-blowing. Now, I don't know what sort of gifts you've received in your life, but have you ever received a gift that is just so massive, it overwhelmed you, it left you speechless? Imagine someone came to you and said, here's a house. Someone came to you and said, here's $5 million. You'd just be astounded by the generosity. Well, what God has given us is far bigger than a house, is far bigger than $5 million. God has, in his generosity, given us the greatest gift he could possibly ever give, and that gift is salvation. He has saved us from a terrible, terrible situation, and he has saved us for a relationship with himself. See, what is the greatest thing that God could possibly give us? The God who is wonderful and beautiful and kind and compassionate and good and righteous and just and holy. What is the greatest thing that God could ever give? Himself. And so that's what God gives us. He saves us from a terrible situation, and he saves us for a relationship with him, the most wonderful thing that he could ever possibly give us. And he gives it to totally undeserving people, which is the other component to grace. The other component is that we are the recipient is undeserving. Now, you get a sense of that from the way that we use the word gracious today. Now, not graceful. Graceful. If I was graceful, I'd dance across the stage, I'd pirouette a couple of times, I'd do a demi-plie, which I hope is not something rude. And you just go, oh, that was so graceful, Graham. You just beautifully, you move so beautifully, you're graceful. Now, that's graceful. Not talking about that. What we're talking about is gracious. Gracious is when someone has done wrong, and instead of you treating them the way they deserve, you treat them with generosity. Now, imagine this situation. You're a waiter or a waitress. You're coming to carry out someone's meal. The kitchen's been slow. They've been waiting for quite a long time. You rush. You trip. You flip the plate. It bounces on the table and straight into their lap. Now, how does the person respond? Well, they could justifiably be upset. They could be angry. They could storm out, say, I'm never going to eat here ever again. Or imagine this. Imagine they speak to you kindly. They say they understand how these things can happen. They allow you to go and get another meal, to bring it out, to serve them again. When you bring it to them, they say thank you. Not sarcastically, not rudely, genuinely. Genuinely, they say thank you. And when they leave a tip. They leave a generous tip. Now, wouldn't you just think at the end of that, wow, they're gracious. I stuffed up. I didn't deserve them to treat me well. And yet, they didn't treat me how I deserved. In fact, they treated me with incredible generosity. They treated me with grace. They were gracious to me. Generosity to the undeserving. That's what grace is. Now, that's a very small example. I don't know if you've ever read the book Les Mis, or watched the movie, or seen the musical, or the movie that is the musical, or the, you know, there's so many incarnations of this story because it's a wonderful story. It really is a rich and beautiful story. I prefer the movie without the singing. I just like people to tell me what's going on rather than sing it, the Liam Neeson one. But it's such a wonderful story because it's about love, sacrifice, and grace. Right towards the beginning of the book, there's this amazing episode that totally changes the main character's life for good. Jean Valjean is a prisoner, had been a prisoner for 19 years. He'd stolen bread, I believe, to feed his sister's starving kids. He's put in jail, and then a couple of times he tries to escape, and so for 19 years he's imprisoned. When they release him from prison, he has to carry with him wherever he goes a yellow passport, which basically says to anyone that he has been a criminal. So anywhere he goes to try to get employment, he has to show the yellow passport. Anywhere he goes to try to get a place to sleep, he has to show the yellow passport. So no one wants him. An ex-con. We don't want to employ you. We don't want you to stay. And so he wanders around trying to find somewhere to get a feed, get a meal, get a place to stay. Until finally, he comes to the residence of the bishop. He didn't want to go there, but when he goes there, the bishop responds with great kindness and generosity. He's a kind old man. He says, come in. He feeds him. Feeds him richly. He provides him with a bed for the night and promises that he's able to stay. Now, how does Jean Valjean repay him? Well, he wakes in the night and he steals the silver cutlery that he saw at dinner. He steals the silver plates that he saw at dinner time and he flees. The next day, Jean Valjean is brought back by the police. They've caught him. And they say to the bishop, this man has your silver cutlery and silver plates and he claims that you gave it to him. Why, yes, says the bishop. Yes, I did give it to him. And Jean Valjean, I am very angry with you. Why didn't you take the silver candlesticks as well? It's worth far more than all of this. Take the silver candlesticks. And he goes and gets the silver candlesticks and puts them in Jean Valjean's bag. And he whispers to Jean Valjean something like this. I have bought your life for God. Now start anew and live it for him. And it radically transforms his life. He does. That is a small picture of the kind of grace that God shows us. The bishop is kind, generous. Jean Valjean takes advantage of it, steals from him. He deserves punishment. But the bishop doesn't give punishment. He shows mercy, lets him off. But not just mercy, grace. Take the candlesticks too. Generosity to the totally undeserving. Now, we're like Jean Valjean. We've been shown such incredible kindness by God. The God who made us and formed us just as we are. The God who has given us life and breath, health, friends, family, the things we enjoy, everything that is good. And yet, how do we respond to God? By ignoring him. By refusing to obey him. By treating him as if he was very, very small and very, very unimportant indeed compared to ourselves. And so we, like Jean Valjean, deserve punishment for that. But instead of punishment, what does God do? He shows mercy. In Jesus, he makes a way where we are not punished. But even more than that, God shows to us grace. Not only not punishing us, but instead lavishing generosity upon generosity upon us. Take the candlesticks too. Not only do I forgive you, not only do I wipe your wrongs clean, not only are you saved from the punishment you deserve, but now you have a relationship with me, adopted as the children of God, loved by the God who gives us purpose and meaning and hope and eternal future with him. God shows his amazing grace. It's not just amazing because of how big the gift is, salvation for relationship with him. It's also amazing because it's given to totally undeserving people. Second word, saved. Which brings us to saved. It is by grace you have been saved. God in his incredible generosity has saved us. But you think, well, saved us from what? Now, I've mentioned a little bit about that, what we're saved from, but you get a clearer picture in your handouts in verse 4. In verse 4, it says, we were dead in our transgressions, which again is a weird word to us today. But to transgress is to cross the line. God has clearly marked the line in the sand that we are not to cross, and to transgress is to step across that line. God's clearly marked the line in the sand, the requirements of how we are to live. You heard Sully talk about that. The sort of love and kindness and generosity we're to have towards each other. And the sort of things that would violate that. So don't cross the line in those areas. The way we're to treat God with thankfulness and obedience and love. And the sort of things that would violate that. And so we're not to cross the line in those areas. But the problem according to those verses is we're transgressors. We're line crossers. We keep intentionally, sometimes unintentionally, but often intentionally stepping over the line of God's requirements. We've failed to do what God has required. In fact, if you think about it long enough, you'll realize you've failed to do the things that you require of yourself. The things you know are wrong, you do, I do. The things you know are right, you fail to do, I fail to do. And it says there, not just that we transgress, but it actually says we're dead in our transgressions. It's not like once or twice we do the wrong thing and step across the line. And no, we've fallen dead across the line. You know, we're lying face down on the other side of the line. We're trapped in our disobedience to God and his ways, and we can't get out because dead people can't do anything to save themselves. They just lie there dead, and that's us. Our natural stance is not as we would suppose, which is warmth towards God. Our natural stance towards God is actually coldness, rejection. That Isaiah passage that was read at the beginning of the service, we all like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. Now, I know virtually nothing about sheep, but what it's saying is pretty clear. We've all run off. We've all run off from God. We've all chosen our own path. We've all stopped wanting to follow and obey him, and so we've gone off on our own way, our own path. Me, you, all of humanity, everyone has turned away from living as if God were the most important thing to living as if we were the most important thing. Self-focused and constantly crossing, breaking God's commands, breaking God's requirements, transgressing. And so we stand under the judgment of God. You'll see another word in that passage you have in front of you, wrath. The just, righteous anger of God for transgression. The just, righteous anger of God for breaking his requirements. Now, with most people, if you do them wrong, how do they treat you? Well, generally, they treat you bad back. Or at very best, they write you off. But not God. In spite of all this, God, the God of all the universe, comes to us. The God who created all things becomes a human being. God the Son becomes human while remaining fully God. He becomes Jesus. God comes near and he steps into our world of pain. He steps into the mess of our lives because he loves you and he will not let you go. He wants to be gracious to you. Amazing generosity to the totally undeserving. But more than that, Jesus came knowing that he would die for us. In fact, Jesus came in order that he would die a horrific death to save us. If you'd been there those over 2,000 years ago on that Good Friday and you had the eyes to see it, what you would have seen is God having the skin flayed from his back as he was flogged. You would have seen God being beaten and bruised by soldiers and a crown of thorns jammed upon his head and him being mocked. You would have seen God carrying the instrument of his execution, the crossbeam of his cross. You would have seen God stripped naked, lifted up in shame and humiliation, nails driven through his wrists and his feet, dying asphyxiating in agony for you and for me to draw us back to himself. But more than that, Jesus came knowing that in that death, he would stand under the judgment of God that we deserve. For all that transgression, for all that wrong, for all that turning away from God,
Jesus stood in our place to save us from the punishment that we deserve. We have been saved by grace. Saved from the punishment of being shut off from God now and forever to be brought into a relationship with God. Now, this is the most generous, gracious thing that God could ever possibly do so that we can live forever with God. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. And the grace is so amazing because the gift is so big. Save for a relationship with God. It is paid at such incredible cost. It cost the life of God the Son and is so totally undeserving. It's for wretches like you and me. If you've seen the Angelina Jolie directed movie Unbroken, it came out in 2014, I think, it's an incredible true story about the man Louis Zamperini. He's an Italian-American. He grew up in California, but because he looked different, he was picked on, he was beaten up by other kids, and so he got angry. He got in heaps of fights, he stole stuff, he drank, and he was going down a bad path until he was directed into the path of athletics, and he found that he was a brilliant runner. He ran and he ran and he got better until he eventually went to the Berlin Olympics and he placed eighth. However, his Olympic dreams were cut short. He didn't have the chance to train for the next Olympics because World War II broke out. Louis became a bomber pilot fighting the Japanese, and it was shot down over the Pacific Ocean. Pretty much everyone on the plane was killed. He and two others survived, and for 47 days they floated around in the Pacific Ocean in a little inflatable raft. They had to fight off sharks, huge storms. They had to ration the small amount of food they had. They had to catch birds and fish with their hands and eat them raw. One of them died, two survived, and eventually they were washed up on a Japanese-occupied island. So safe to then be imprisoned, questioned, mistreated as prisoners of war, but they gave up no information. Louis then was moved to Japan. He was in a concentration camp for the next 2 years where he was brutally mistreated. There was a particular Japanese corporal there who they called the Bird, who took a great dislike to Louis. Louis, this great American hero, you know, this great Olympian, this runner, he particularly brutalized and picked on him in order to try and break him. And the whole movie, as the title suggests, focuses on the human will and spirit that Louis, no matter what happened to him, no matter what the Bird inflicted upon him, he would not be broken. He would not betray his country. He would not stand down and be broken by the Bird and have his spirit broken. Towards the end of the movie, the Bird forces Zamperini to hold this massive chunk of wood on his shoulders. And if he drops it, he was to be shot. But he holds it emaciated, withered, holds it by sheer willpower alone. And in the movie, he actually lifts it above his head in one of those triumphant moments. And then the American army arrives and they're liberated. Now, that's where the movie ends. But this story that is about a man who would not be broken by the worst inhumane treatment, this story about a man who is a testimony to the power of the human spirit, gets even better after the movie ends. When Zamperini comes home, everything goes well. He marries his childhood sweetheart. He has two kids. He gets a bunch of money because he's insured. He's got back pay for while he's been in prison. He goes on speaking tours because he's a famous guy. He's the Olympian who survived being a prisoner of war, and here he is back. But then it all spirals out of control. He gets into drinking, partying, womanizing. He spirals into selfishness, cynicism, greed, alcoholism. He loses all his money. He breaks his promises to God. You can imagine, stranded out at sea 47 days, he prayed to God, "God, if you save me, I will serve you the rest of my life." In prison, "God, if you save me, I will serve you the rest of my life." He broke those promises to God, and he was filled with deep anger and anxiety and depression and hatred, constantly concocting plans about how he would get back to Japan and murder the Bird for the evil that he had done to him. Louis Zamperini was not unbroken. He was broken. Terrible things had been done to him, but the brokenness really came from inside. He was a transgressor who could not get out, who could not fix things up, one who had wandered far away from God and needed God in his generosity to come and save him. It got to the point that his wife threatened to divorce him if he wouldn't come along to the Billy Graham crusade at that time. Billy Graham is a famous evangelist, only died a few weeks ago. Zamperini went the first night and it filled him with anger and he refused to return. But his wife persuaded him, under pain of divorce, persuaded him one last time, come along. That night he heard about a God who is so generous, so loving, so forgiving that all his wrongs could be forgiven. All his broken promises, all his turning his back on his wife and God, all his anger and hatred and all that he had done could be forgiven. And he turned his life over to Jesus, that Jesus had died so he did not have to. And that night, Zamperini became a Christian. He went home, he poured his alcohol down the drain, and he started a new life as a child of God. He sold his business. He dedicated the rest of his life to running outdoor Christian camps and programs for underprivileged boys. And he went back to Japan and he found all the Japanese officers who had so brutally mistreated him, and he looked them in the face and he forgave them. He even tried to find the bird and forgive him, but he heard that the bird was dead, and so he wrote him a letter proclaiming that he forgave him and he hoped that he would become a Christian too. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see. God, in his amazing generosity, has given us salvation. And if you look a little later in the sentence, you can see it is the gift of God. A gift freely given, not something we earn. All we need to do is receive it. Which brings us to the third word, faith. What's faith? Again, it's one of those words that is often misunderstood. People think faith is believing something there is absolutely no evidence for. People think faith is believing the totally unbelievable. It's just a blind leap into the dark. But that's not what the Bible means when it talks about faith. Faith means trusting the trustworthy. Faith really just means trust. Just as I substitute generosity for grace, I substitute trust for faith every time I see it come up in the Bible. And the important thing about trust is who you trust, whether they're trustworthy. You don't trust a dodgy, broken chair to sit on it because it's going to let you down and hurt you. You don't trust a proven, crooked, lying investment advisor with your money because they're going to blow it or run off with it or something. You don't trust a cricket player with a bit of yellow tape that's sitting in his... That's a bit harsh. If the thing or person is not trustworthy, don't trust them because it's going to let you down. But if the person is trustworthy, you can trust them. I've found throughout life, as I trust people who are trustworthy, they don't let me down because they come good on their promises and the things they've said. What God has done in his generosity to save us is absolutely trustworthy. Jesus' death, God says, is enough to draw you back into relationship with him, to bring complete forgiveness. We can trust that because God has never, ever broken a promise. Trust and you're saved. You see, how do you trust a chair? Well, it's not by you doing any work to hold yourself up. You're just sitting in the chairs there tonight. You've entrusted yourself to them by just sitting. The chair has done the work. The chair is doing the work. You just entrust yourself to the chair by putting your weight upon it. Same with God. He has done all the work. It is by his grace you have been saved. All we do is place our weight upon him, upon his promises, upon what he has done. Entrust ourselves to him. God in his generosity has done it all, done everything to save us, and we can totally trust him because he never breaks his promises. So entrust yourself to him. Trust that God in his generosity has saved you by the death of Jesus. You are saved. For it is by grace you've been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, not by works. Final word, so that no one can boast. Now, do you see the contrast? On the one hand, there's a gift that can be received just by trusting. On the other hand, there's working for your salvation. On the one hand, it's a free gift. Just take it. Just trust. God in his generosity has done it all. On the other hand, it's you earn it, you merit it, you work for it, you be gooder, You know, you be more religious. You do more religious rituals. You come to church more. You make up for your wrongs. You pray more. You say more confessions. You make pilgrimage to Mecca. You go to confession. You, whatever you, it might be, you've got to do it. Now, every religion in the world is this. You do it. You earn your salvation. You make yourself acceptable to God. You earn right relationship with God. You earn heaven or life after death. But that is not Christianity. Can you see how emphatic the Apostle Paul is? And this is not from yourselves, he says. It is the gift of God, not by works, so that no one can boast. It's not by us working. We cannot earn it. We cannot make up for the wrong we have done. You imagine a police officer pulls you over for drink driving and you say, but I didn't speed all last week. He says, oh, well, you know, if you didn't speed, then you're not in trouble for drink driving. Or I'm not going to speed for the next week. Oh, if you're not going to speed for the... No. If you've done the crime, then you will be punished for the crime. All the wrong that we have done before God, to others, must be punished by the just judge. Because otherwise it'd be absolutely unfair to everyone else who he had wronged. Actually, if God just swept under the carpet the things that had been done wrong to us. And God himself would be unjust, which is not possible. He is justice. We cannot make up for the things that we have done wrong. There must be punishment, which is why Jesus steps in our place to take that punishment. And even if we tried to be good and we tried to be moral and we tried to be loving, we constantly fail. We're transgressors. We're line crossers. We can't be good enough. We cannot earn our salvation. Now, do you remember the Beaconsfield miners? You know, that mine collapse? They were trapped almost a kilometre underground in the dark, in the machinery that they'd been working in. The overhead was rubble, loose rocks, which threatened at any moment to come through, falling down upon them and crushing them. And so the rescuers had to create another shaft to come and save them. They burrowed deep, deep down through the rock using explosives, using drilling equipment. They came to save them. It took them 2 weeks. Now, can you imagine that? 2 weeks underground. 2 weeks it took them to get to them. Now, how cruel would it have been for someone to have said to those guys, dig, you do it. You work. You get yourself out. You save yourself. You can do it. Absolutely impossible. Absolutely cruel. Thankfully, the rescue came from above, came from the outside. People in their generosity worked hard and won them by their work. Now, that's us. We need someone on the outside. We need someone from above. We need God himself in his generosity to do the work in order to save us. And that's what God in his incredible generosity, his crazy grace, has done for us. Not by works, so that no one can boast. We didn't do anything. So there's no boasting on our behalf. Christians should be the most humble and thankful people alive. Humble because we didn't do anything in order to save ourselves and make ourselves right with God. And thankful because God has done it all at incredible cost to himself. Which is one of the reasons why we sing and we sing and we sing, because we are so thankful what he has done. Let's pull it all together. For it is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God. Not by works, so that no one can boast. God in his incredible generosity has saved us by the death of his son Jesus in our place on that Good Friday all those years ago. It's a gift. It's a gift. A free gift for anyone who will receive it. And you receive it just by trusting. You can't earn it. You can't work for it. We can't make up for the wrong we've done. We can't be good enough. It must be a gift from God. Just trust. It's all generosity. Amazing grace. How sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. I was blind, but now I see. Now that's the sort of thing that every Christian sings. I've been a wretch. I'm a wretch, but I've been saved by God's generosity alone. That's the heart of Good Friday. Let's pray. Oh, Father, we thank you that you are the God who is so kind and good and generous, that instead of writing us off for the way we've mistreated you, the way that we've mistreated others, Instead, you draw near in your generosity. You come to us, you die for us, you take the punishment we deserve in order to save us. Not by anything we've done, not by our works, but just by trusting in the free gift that you offer to us. Father, I pray that all of us would receive that gift by faith. And Father, I pray that all of us would be filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy for the salvation that we have in Jesus, that it is now and will come in all its fullness when he returns. And we pray this in his name. Amen.